Welcome to Holy Unhappiness, conversations about the expectations we have of what the life of faith will feel like. I'm your host, Amanda Held Opelt, author of the book Holy Unhappiness, God, Goodness, and the Myth of the Blessed Life. Each week, I'll be speaking with writers, pastors, artists, and friends about the myths we believe about the good life. Together, we'll reimagine what blessing can look like if we are willing to look beyond our culture's definition of happiness and success. Welcome. I'm glad you're here. Welcome back to our series on Mental Health Awareness Month. Today, I am really excited to talk with my friend from down the road, Meredith McDaniel. She is a licensed clinical mental health counselor, a PhD candidate, and the clinical director of Milk and Honey Counseling in Davidson, North Carolina. She's also a local speaker and author and published her debut book, In Want and Plenty, in 2020, and it guides the reader on a wilderness journey deeper into their story to find their true identity. Meredith is currently working towards her PhD in counselor education and supervision at Concordia University in Irvine, California. She has a heart for educating and supervising the next generation of licensed counselors to become ethically minded and skillfully sound. She leans into narrative theory, which reminds us that no one must remain stuck in their story if they are willing to look back, look around, and look ahead by imagining what could be. Meredith has a heart for healthy leadership in all fields of helpers and enjoys working with those who are willing to consider their own story and the impact their lens has on those they counsel, pastor, and lead in the various settings where they work. Gosh, that is so important. Meredith's dissertation will be centering around the topic of the well-being of those who care and those who lead as well. Meredith's desire is to offer hope in dark places, helping others taste the land of milk and honey right here on earth by creating safe spaces that serve as a healing balm over time to find calm in the chaos. There's something about Meredith's disposition that for me is just so disarming and comforting and approachable. So I was able to ask her some really hard questions that I've been wrestling with. So please, please, please keep listening. Hi, Meredith. It is so great to have you on the podcast. Thank you so much for coming on.
So good to be with you, Amanda.
I'm going to be honest with you about my real agenda for the day. And that is, number one, I just want to be your friend. And I feel like we have mutual friends. We live relatively close to one another, about 2 hours away.
We do.
And we chat online sometimes, but I was like, I just really want to have like a real conversation with you and dive deep into some things. And so that's part of my agenda for this conversation. My other agenda is that I've been having some really awesome conversations with mental health professionals and psychologists and pastors about this intersection of faith and mental health. And this won't be the last episode that airs, but it is the last conversation that I'm having. And so I kind of wanted someone that I felt like would be safe to just kind of talk through some of the like unanswered questions I feel like I still have, if that makes
sure.
sense. And so I don't know. Hopefully I'll be able to kind of maybe make sense of some of the questions and get them out in a way that is clear. But I don't know. I just feel like I wanted to debrief with you. I just wanted to talk with somebody about some of the things that I still feel unresolved about. Like, this is a complex issue and I haven't figured everything out. And so it's like, you know, maybe I'll have a conversation with Meredith and she can help me with that. Are you up for that?
I am. Well, let me just tell you, last time I saw you, I was like doubled over in pain, and we were talking about abdominal pain at a writing conference. So this is a much better setting today. And I think I'm just going to visualize us sitting by the creek that I just sat with in the Blue Ridge Mountains with our mutual friends not too long ago, and pretend that we're sitting there, even though we're both in our houses today on a kind of dreary spring day.
Yes, it is. It's gross outside, and we're having some technology issues with the podcast platform, but we are going to have a good conversation. I just feel it.
We are.
I have so much respect for you, for your presence online, for the work that you do. I mean, you are really in the nitty gritty of the mental health world, like seeing clients and, you know, hearing their issues and holding their stories. And so I think you have a real wisdom to offer. And the question I kind of wanted to start with today is, I don't know if you saw this online. I kind of hope you didn't, because I don't know, Twitter/X, mm-hmm. it's not always a happy place to be. But right. Recently, someone posted on there a video of a prominent pastor who went on record saying that there's no such thing as PTSD or OCD or ADHD. And I'm really grateful that so many Christian psychologists and pastors kind of came out and really denounced that statement and said that this is harmful. This is not a healthy way to talk about these things.
Yes.
So I think it is pretty common in the church for people to view mental illness with some level of suspicion. Right?
Right.
I don't know if you've seen that. So I want to hear from you what you would say to Christians who maybe are a bit skeptical about the reality of mental health challenges. And what do you wish the average pastor or church leader understood about the things your clients struggle with?
Sure. Do you have a week for us to sit here and talk about that question, Amanda? I mean, there's so much to say. I think initially, when I did hear about the video, I haven't watched it specifically, but my heart just breaks, because I think what you just said, I mean, it starts to stigmatize even more so the reality and the lived experience of so many people. I mean, it's my experience to walk through this world as a broken body with a broken mind, but also someone who's experienced a lot of healing and transformation. Both through the power of my relationship with God and the pairing of psychology and therapy and just the integration of those two. And so I think it's harmful when we're not willing to name and say the truth and reality that science and our bodies actually lines up a lot with scripture and what God says about the brokenness and the fallenness of this world. And so, I mean, from my perspective, we come from a creator who knit us together. I mean, I go right to Psalm 139 with a distinct design. Like, he knew what he was doing. And so our brains and our nervous system is very complex. And if we do believe that God is all-knowing, then that means he knew what it was going to look like back there in the garden. And I would have chosen the same thing, by the way, if I was standing there in front of that tree. Mm-hmm. And he knew that our bodies were going to have a hard time metabolizing that. And so we have this intricate nervous system that helps us to be able to really cope in this world. And so for someone to stand up and say, or sit down and say even, that those realities don't exist. I mean, it really is the definition of, and I know this is a buzz term, so I hesitate to even use it, but of gaslighting someone's experience. Mm-hmm. And so my challenge would be to pastors, would you be willing to look in the mirror yourself and ask mm-hmm. yourself the hard questions? Where do I struggle? You know, where is it actually more than grief? Could it be that there's a chemical imbalance that starts to happen and we don't always know the origin of that? But are you willing to look at yourself and your own story? But are you also willing to look at the stories of those who are hurting and coming before you that are in deep pain and lament, but also might need something extra beyond prayer or beyond just the tying a bow on a situation or circumstance?
Well, I think, you know, I think the role of the shepherd, the role of the pastor, if nothing else, it's to walk in empathy with people.
Yes.
And it is really true that if you maybe haven't experienced a trauma or haven't experienced the impact of PTSD, or you haven't, if you don't know what it's like to be in a brain that's struggling with a chemical imbalance, yes, it's actually quite hard to understand. It's hard for me to describe. I mean, the hours I have spent trying to describe my experience to my husband, who wants to learn and wants to understand. But I think that there, when so much of pastoral emphasis now is on standing on a stage and presenting content to people, as opposed to walking alongside, being with people in those hard spaces, where's the space for understanding the story, for absorbing the story, digesting the story of people who struggle with mental health challenges in their churches? You know, we just don't emphasize that alongsideness anymore.
Well, and that takes time and it's really messy. And so I think the question I would ask, and I ask myself, is when I feel myself pulling away or wanting to look the other way, like we see actually in Ezekiel, where I've been hanging out a lot lately, we want to divert our eyes. We want to deny reality, both for ourselves and for others, because we don't want to have to come to terms. And so if we can really challenge ourselves, to not look away and to walk towards as Jesus would and did, and we have such an example of him doing, if we want to be more like him, have more of the mind of Christ, you're right. We have to lead with empathy and care. And he's going to meet us there and give us the strength to actually do that and to bear the burden of the other in front of us in a way that then, and this is something I have to practice a lot with my counseling, to then hand that person and that situation back off into his care. Because I don't know about you, but I can't walk around carrying the weight of my people under my roof, much less everybody else I encounter. And I have sensitivity to that with pastors. Because it is a lot to bear, especially over the last 5 years, what people are walking through with the increased mental illness in our country, but really in our world.
Yeah. And the hope would be that pastors would recognize that there are tools available to them to help them carry these challenges that maybe feel outside their realm of expertise, that maybe they feel they're in over their head on. And if they would trust clinical professionals, even Christian, you know, licensed Christian therapists like yourself, to help them hold some of this stuff. I would love to hear, you know, because this is something you do, you know, on a weekly basis, I would love for you to help our listeners kind of understand what are some of the issues that you're seeing people face in kind of today's social landscape. You know, obviously we are post-COVID. Well, that maybe shouldn't say post-COVID. We are in the aftermath of COVID, which is still ongoing in many ways. We have so much polarization in our political landscape. We have faith deconstruction as a major topic of conversation going on. What are some of the things that you're seeing people really struggle with?
Yeah, well, I mean, you're nailing it. I think every session, somebody is coming into my office right now, just with the heartache of not being seen and not being known in their story. And so I've been learning a lot about, what does discourse look like? How can we stay in a room with people? Sometimes we have to leave rooms, right? But how can we stay in a room and continue the conversation? And so a lot of what I'm hearing, you know, whether it is spiritual abuse or, you know, the church hurt conversation, or it is just that, like I said, like that loneliness and disconnect that people are feeling, because, you know, we hold our phones all day long and it's this false sense of connection, and they bring goodness into our life. So it's not all bad. but I think people are extremely lonely because it's this false sense of connection. And so there's also so many other things rooted in the phone, right? Or in any form of a screen, where when people feel disconnected in their actual relationships, they're turning to other places to get that satisfaction. But it's short term and it doesn't last. And so there is a lot of addiction. I feel like addiction's always on the rise in some ways. Statistically, it actually looks different than it used to. But a lot of it is because it's hidden. It's not as forthright, right? And so I think probably the last thing that I would say a theme is just this confusion. People are standing in this gap between really what we've already been talking about. You know, they're learning some things in therapy, or they're reading books and really starting to critically think about their faith and beliefs that they've had forever. And then they're starting to see all of the social discourse around us and the polarization, like you mentioned. And they're asking the question, like, how do I keep a relationship with God potentially when I don't necessarily agree with everything that's happening around me, or my story hasn't been held well, like I've been bypassed in a process, and what do I need to own? Where do I need to grow? But also, where do I need to call out and name, you know, where I've been harmed, even in conversation? And so, holding that tension with people who have not experienced attunement. And their stories have not been held well, and wanting to create and rebuild that trust and cultivate safety with them. It just feels like a high honor and heartbreaking gift to get to sit in those spaces with people every day.
Yeah. I want to name, I have a counselor that I've seen for about 8 years who has just made all the difference in the world for me. And I mentioned feeling like there are some things that were unresolved still in my mind and heart. And I joke, I'm not expecting you to help me reach resolution on this. But I think one of the things I kind of struggle with is this idea of pathologizing pain and pathologizing the difficult emotions that we feel in kind of our modern day world. And I think I struggle with it because I think I want this very clear line of demarcation that says, like, once you cross this line and you're experiencing this, this, and this, you officially have a disorder, a chemical imbalance, something we can name, something we can kind of attach a diagnosis to, and then we will treat you with A, B, and C, and you will be fine. And I think it's actually in my experience, and I don't really want to go into the details of my own mental health challenges, but in my experience, it's been really hard to know, like, okay, is what I'm feeling just like kind of the normal, like, this is a appropriate response to some of the things we've experienced as a society and I've experienced as a human in this world. Mm-hmm. And what I need are some just tools to cope with it, and some pastoral care and some professional help to kind of get through this. Right. Or when do I know that, like, this is within the realm of maybe needing a more medical intervention? So that's a big question. I don't know that I really even gave you warning I was going to ask you that, but is there a way that you would kind of speak to someone about that, about whether that line actually exists?
Yes.
Or whether or not kind of mental health is this kind of sticky, messy, hard to put your fingers on sometime, and we just kind of do the best we can with the tools we have. I don't know. I'd love to hear you speak to that.
Yeah. Oh, I was actually watching something the other day, and somebody was talking about how there's so much conversation about, you know, we need to get our bodies back into homeostasis and our nervous systems calm and to be grounded. And that is true. That is how I want to feel. However, that's not always the goal. Like, sometimes we need to be above that line and be in a hyper arousal and a hypo arousal because it motivates us. And so my question would be, like, could we let ourselves be really curious, and what can we learn from the anxiety or the depression, whatever, you know, level of the spectrum it is on? And I think you're asking that question, like, how do I know, like, when do I need to seek help even maybe, or when do I need to seek a different kind of help? And we can talk in a second about maybe a more collaborative approach that I would hope that the church and our communities could start to have. So don't let me forget about that. But I actually was flipping through your book earlier just to refresh my memory on a couple things. And one of the lines I had highlighted more than anything, Amanda, was on 129. And it says, a limit does not confine as much as it defines, which is really interesting, right? That's what you're bringing up right now in this space, because a hemming in, if we want to talk about the Ten Commandments, or we want to talk about a shepherd with his staff, like, we see that as limitation and scarcity, when in reality, there can be so much abundance there. And so one of your other questions, I think, before was just this idea of, like, labeling and naming. And for me, as a clinician, what that brings to mind is abundance. And so when I sit with somebody, and, you know, I'm not very diagnose driven because I don't take insurance. And so I don't have to put those official labels on people. Yep. which is a gift. But if I use that as a lens, like if I were to refer to the DSM in the back of my brain or actually pull it out, having those criteria helps people to know where they are on that spectrum that you're talking about of severity. And so it's so case by case. So you might need one thing where a client or a friend or whoever I'm talking to might need something else, or I might need something else. And so that springboards me into this collaborative piece. Like, yeah, I have a spiritual director right now, and I have a therapist right now who are scaffolding for me and helping hold me up in some hard in my life. And there will be a season where I don't have both of those things as frequently as I have, right? And then there's seasons where we need medication to kind of level out those chemicals in our brain. Some people need those long term. Some people need them for a short period to get their head back up above water based on life circumstances. And sometimes prayer and being able to sit by a creek. Or for me, I took my shoes off in my field the other day and literally just stood in the sun. I was like, I know I need vitamin D and I just need to breathe and know that I'm alive.
Right.
And so, yeah, I mean, when your quality of life is tanking, like you can't function day to day, try not to get to that place. But if you do, yeah, you're going to need more intervention and it could be for a season. But could we also be okay with being in that, not perfectly grounded state, because what does it have to teach us?
Right.
What do we need to know? What's our body telling us?
Yeah. But Meredith, the avoidance of pain and suffering, like happiness is the highest goal of like modern American humans, like self-help, self-improvement, self-care, well-being, all the products we have. It's like, we feel like we should be able to reach this state of complete mental tranquility all the time. Right. And if we aren't, then we kind of judge ourselves for not kind of being true to this moral imperative we have in this society now, which is be happy, do what you got to do to be true to yourself and make yourself happy. And if you aren't experiencing that, then you've kind of failed. Does that make sense? Like that
totally makes
sense. Struggle for me.
Well, and that's my goal too. I want to feel peace. I want to feel joy. Like I want to feel at ease and comfortable in my skin. And so sure, we can strive for that. But I mean, again, back to the point of your whole book, it seems like holy unhappiness. Like what does that have to offer us in this world? Well, we have to lean on people. We have to lean on a creator who actually, you know, knows and sees further down the road than we do. And so we actually can rest, as crazy as it seems, in the mystery and in the unknowing and in that tension of the both and. And I mean, I think we both love music. And so for me, sometimes I let myself deepen my affect by listening to some darker, more moody tunes, you know, and then I'll get that folksy, bluegrassy vibe that will help kind of take me there. And so I don't know. I think embracing the fullness of our emotion. Jesus did that too.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
He flipped tables.
Yeah.
He let his righteous anger show. He didn't keep it all tidy and close.
Yeah. Well, and I'm sure we'd both be happy to give a plug for our friend John Lucas if you need some music to help you feel all the feels.
We would.
But yeah, I love how you talk about this integration of kind of the faith aspect and maybe the more kind of clinical mental health aspect. And I, part of what the thing that inside me is just feeling maybe confused, maybe curious, is this fear maybe of swinging pendulums that I think for so long the church has mishandled mental health, has denied that mental health challenges were a reality. Mm-hmm. And so now I feel like people are trying to create this separation between the two because they don't want pastors mucking it up like they have in the past so much. But I also think there's something to be said about pastoral care and or mentorship or community that offers us something different than a more clinical setting. Would you agree?
I do agree. And that's a little bit why I kind of cracked that door open of like spiritual direction. But I could fill that in with, pastoral care, mentorship, discipleship, any sort of shepherding where you're coming alongside people. I think the key is just everyone sort of knowing and having awareness. So if we want to have that trauma-informed lens, just like what you were talking about earlier, like when is the point where someone does need to be not referred out as in I'm handing someone off, again, it's like collaboration. Like I'm starting to see churches really want that and seek that out. You're right. Some other churches are saying, let's part ways. And that's always been there, that divide. I mean, we've got the first integrationist, like in the 70s and 80s, like Crabb and Allender. And then we've got, you know, more modern day, you know, ones that are emerging as well. But that's been there for a long time. And so my hope is we can start to like narrow that gap again. There's this really beautiful book for anybody listening that just came out through IVP. And I just met the author recently in Atlanta at this conference. But his name is James Sells, and it's called Beyond the Clinical Hour. And so it is for clinicians and students in counseling. That is probably his audience. But I would highly recommend it for pastors, because if people can start to recognize there can be this bridge that we can create where spiritual practices, which we are actually finding, like, right, mindfulness, yoga, centering, prayer, you know, they really actually marry really well. If we can kind of join forces and link arms, I think something really beautiful can happen in our congregations and our communities. So we have to ask ourselves again, like, what are we scared of? What could actually be here for us to do together? And the power of prayer. I mean, can we talk about that for a second? Like, prayer doesn't always yield a particular outcome. Mm-hmm. Like you said earlier, like A plus B equals C. My life doesn't work that way. My client's life doesn't work that way. I don't see life being linear. So for me, prayer is more like of a connection with and a conversation where I recognize I'm not alone and someone's listening and someone's hopefully there, right? Like that's where faith comes in. So what would you say more about your question? Like, yes, there's a tug to the local church. I love that about you. I'm with you on that. And the spiritual practices and disciplines, like how do you see that merging some for you?
I think I've just recognized that, like I said, my counselor, like I think she may have saved my life. Like she really has helped me navigate kind of this complex set of circumstances I've walked through over the last 8 years.
Yes.
And also like she is a face in a screen, you know what I mean?
Right.
And it's kind of, she has these very appropriate, professional boundaries in which she, you know, we don't like hang out in real life. I mean, she doesn't live here, but you know, we don't hang out in real life. Right. She doesn't really have the opportunity to observe me outside of that screen. And so what I love, what I feel like has really helped me and worked for me is not only having her kind of bringing that really focused, a little bit more clinical, more, you know, kind of cognitive behavioral, all of that stuff in our one-on-one time, but also a spiritual mentor that can kind of say, hey, Amanda, I'm noticing she's just observing how I'm actually living out the tools that my counselor is giving me.
That's
and
so
she kind of has this more, her role is maybe to speak in a more, with some admonition, maybe in a way that a counselor's role isn't. And I have to give her permission for that. I think she always seeks my consent to do that. But to me, that's kind of filled in some of the gaps of like, okay, is there somebody that can actually watch me in real time and help me see how I'm doing in a way that maybe a clinical counselor can't, if that makes sense.
It does. Well, and I think what you're hitting on, there's almost like more accountability in the day to day. And I know that word can bring up a lot.
I know.
But a beautiful accountability where it's attunement that we were talking about earlier and more embodied, right? So some people have therapists that they're meeting with in person, which is great, more rare these days. But having that person that is in your community and in your life and maybe around your family and sees you in those moments that isn't that one slice of an hour. I do think it's really important and we don't want to disregard that. We need to highly value it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned a helpful book. So speaking of beautiful books, in your book, In Want and Plenty, which I hope everyone listening checks out, it's so helpful. Why did you use the image of manna in the wilderness as a driving force behind your book? I mean, that sounds a little bit like leaning into the discomfort and making space for pain and exile and abandonment. Like, why did you use manna in the wilderness? How does that speak to you?
Mm-hmm. Well, I've joked with a lot of people lately that I, you know, it's weird when you write a book. I feel like I wrote it 10 years ago because it came out 5 years ago. And that, you know, there's so many things that you would go back in and tweak and change. But I will tell you the thing I wouldn't is that concept of mana, because I think I wrote it then. I didn't know for the season I'm in now, which is that I need to lean on that daily sustenance. And the thing that I think was distinct about the concept that I had, because a lot of us talk about Exodus and that paralleling, you know, our story with God and the deliverance and everything and the freedom that comes there. But with the manna specifically, like, I've been blown away how God has uniquely tailored it to me. So I could be riding down the road and see something or hear something, and what it means to me in that moment, and how I see that I am seen and known by someone out there bigger than me. It has happened so many times for me, and I hear about it from other people and their lived experiences, that I just say, oh, that's manna. Oh, that's manna. I mean, it's almost like a breath prayer for me at mm-hmm. this point. And I do hope it's contagious for people, because I doubt every day, and I want to go back into what was familiar. Just like the Israelites, like, we are such a forgetful people, but there's something about that daily sustenance what's provided, even if it doesn't look like what we think we want it to. Like, yeah, sure, I'd love a big green salad or like a big steak. That sounds really hearty and colorful, but there's this like flaky, weird substance that's like full of mystery that means like, what is it? So we're going out throughout our whole lives saying, like, what is this? Why did this happen? Like, I don't get it, but I'm gonna consume it and take it in, and I'm gonna trust that it's gonna be what I need today or this moment or in this breath. So it is, it's really grounding for me, just to lean into that image and that metaphor. Mm-hmm.
I think about the way we use the wilderness as a metaphor now. I almost feel like there's been a little bit of an over romanticizing of the wilderness.
Yeah, I hear you.
And I'm sorry I keep hitting you with all these like hard, complex questions. But I think one of the things I struggle with a little bit is like this, maybe you do receive a mental health diagnosis or you go through this hard time. And what's awesome about our generation is that people are not afraid to name the hard, to admit when they're struggling, and to kind of embrace the lament, if that makes sense. Like, we're really getting good at writing songs of lament after having long silence on that front for many years. And also, back to this pendulum, I never want to be the kind of person who also lets my struggle with anxiety define me either. Right. That it kind of gives me this almost like a status as something that allows me to be seen, or something that allows me to kind of maybe claim some accommodation. I don't know. I think I just am seeing that more and more in this generation of maybe a stuckness almost. Yes. And that's hard to address, because there is going to be a level which you may struggle your whole life. And we don't want, we want to name that and be with you in that and pronounce dignity over that. And also, I would never want to be somebody who loses hope that I can find some resolve, that this isn't all of who I am, if that makes sense. Like, how do I keep my anxiety from becoming the fullness of my identity?
Yes. Oh, I love this question. So I think we've got to come back to, what is our true identity? You know, like, if we were just to sit there for a second and think, like, who am I? How was I made? Why am I here? Like, what is my purpose? What am I specifically, like, me and you specifically, Amanda, and whoever's listening, like, what are you supposed to bring into this world? I think it gets it back to less of this victim mentality, which, again, I know that can stir and ruffle some feathers, because we are victim to a lot in this world, whether it's people or just tragedy, sickness, all the things. But how do we then move through that, metabolize that? And if it's holding on, if it's a diagnosis or a label, or if it's just the reality of grief or anxiety or depression, right? Whatever it is, however it fleshes out, if we can get back to that true identity, that you're right, like, this does not define me. This is something that I am going to battle through for a season, or I'm going to battle through chronically for my whole life, right? And I've got some dear friends, and you do too, right? Authors that are speaking into the chronic illness. It's like this constant ache that can be lifelong on this side of heaven, right? Gosh, I mean, to put that into like one phrase, it's like, can we look past just even for a second, like what is right in front of us? I talk about this in my book a little bit about how God can see like this aerial view, like he sees it all. Like, can we have some sort of context that there's way more than what's right here? Last year I turned 40, scary and empowering.
That's happening for me in 2 weeks.
Oh, 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Okay. So you have to
actually, when this airs, it'll be, yeah, it's my birthday, everybody. Wish me a happy birthday.
Happy almost 40th. Like you have to mark it. So last year I was on my way to school in California, working on my doctorate out there. And I just decided I'm going to go to Joshua Tree a few days before. Highly recommend it. It was pretty much like walking through my book, like embodied, like, and all the cactus, I didn't get to go to the place where they were blooming. So I'm like wandering around metaphorically, but literally in this dry 117 heat. No one's there because it was the worst time of year to go ever, but it was just when I was going. But I did, I was holding out, if we can hold that image of like, where was the blooming cactus? Like, it's gotta be somewhere. Like, I feel parched. I feel stuck in my story. I feel paralyzed. I'm dry. Can I just go find that bloom? And I knew it was somewhere. Yeah. I didn't actually get to see it while I was there, so I'm gonna have to go back. But it's holding out that there's something right here, but then there's also something out there that we can't fully name and we don't fully know what it's going to be.
I think that like sometimes in our culture, it's like how we feel is who we are. Like the sum of our identity, we associate with how we feel. And it's a huge part of who we are. It's a huge part of what we bring to our experience. And also, like, I had a really rough weekend from a mental health perspective. And also, I like planted my garden and I went to church and I did it. Like, I made a meal and I ate and I spent time with my kids, and that's who I am too. All of those things make me who I am. It's that internal struggle does not define everything about my story. And I think if we can hold all those things in tension, then we have a much bigger picture of what life can be like, if that makes sense.
Yes. And I just want to real quickly circle back to the empathy. So when we experience deep pain, we start to see the other in front of us through a whole new lens. So I don't care if we're talking about all the hot topics or we're just talking about what you've just walked through, person in front of me. I am going to see you and my heart is going to break and I'm going to feel more connected to you because of my own pain. So letting it have some sort of, and I know all these sayings are so tough. It's like, it's hard to even like utter some of these words, but like letting the pain have some sort of role of purpose in life and with other people so that it can be generative and actually there be plenty and abundance.
Yeah.
Where it does feel scarce at times.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, and you just spoke to the last question I want to ask you, and we're running short on time. I knew this.
Yes.
Yeah, like this idea of like the difference between toxic positivity and like obsessing on silver linings versus actually offering people hope. Like, I was talking with a friend about somebody that they know who self-censors all the time. Like, they say something really genuinely hard that they're going through, and then they say, oh, but you know, I could be, you know, starving in, and then they name a developing country, you know?
Right. Exactly.
As a way of almost diminishing their own pain.
And
that's not good, right?
Mm-mm.
And also what I want to say is there is something generative, there's something restorative about also naming what you are thankful for. It's just that one doesn't negate the other. Does that make sense? I think we need to reclaim some sense of positivity. Like, I don't want to throw all positivity out. I don't want to say that it's all bad and that we only need to sing songs of lament. There's got to be some balance between fully accepting and embracing and being fully present in the pain. And also like remind yourself of what you do have and remind yourself of some of the gifts that you have and the tools you have to walk through these challenges. I don't know. Does that make sense? I'm struggling with, again, that swinging pendulum there.
Let's let it be both. Like, can we just let it hang? We don't need to tie it up. I can have a pit in my stomach over knowing something hard that's coming or has just happened. But like you said, I can go out, walk out there and see that peony that just bloomed in my yard that took 3 years. And there it is, you know, I can have the pit and I can also have that beauty right in my face. And if I can live in that tension and hold both and know that the tension's okay, it doesn't have to all feel perfect right now in this moment. There's a lot of freedom there.
Mm. Yeah, there is. Well, let's end then on a note of freedom. thank you, Meredith, for the work you do, for the way you hold people's stories, for your incredible book that we'll link in the show notes. I'll make sure I put it on social media. But where can people find you if they want to learn more about what you do and what you write?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, milkandhoneycounseling.com is my website. And then I'm Meredith_McDaniel on Instagram. And I get on there here and there when I feel inspired.
Awesome. Wonderful. Well, let's make sure we hang out in person next time. But this has been a lovely conversation. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Amanda.